The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Welcome to Inside the Edition. This is Mike Consul, and my guest is Burl East. He is the CEO of American Assets Capital Advisors, and he also wrote a story recently in the current edition of Real Assets Advisor magazine, that being the June edition, headlined Like Oil and Water, subtitled It's a Case of Environmental Concerns Clashing with Infrastructure Needs. Basically a story about water infrastructure. Burl joins us from San Diego, California via phone. Burl, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be here.
So, Burl, you wrote in Real Assets Advisor an article that says the United States is facing a long-term water problem. Explain that situation to us.
Well, most of the water that is not salt water on the planet is locked up in the form of ice on the polar caps. There's a modest amount, we're talking like a percentage of a percentage, that is in the form of lakes, rivers, and otherwise accessible fresh water proximate to populations. And so that's sort of in bucket A. In bucket B, nationally, we have a water infrastructure. We have piping and pumping and systems and reclamation and storage and a variety of other systems that we've put in place over the last, call it 200 years, to provide folks with access to affordable fresh water. The country really hasn't done much in the way of maintenance or expansion of those systems really since probably the 1950s or 1960s. That was the last time that the country embarked on a dramatic structural increase in CapEx, whether it was road systems or hospitals or water infrastructure or whatever. And so we just have this aging system. I mean, Flint, Michigan would be the perfect example of this. They have not invested in, you know, their purification and water safety systems. But then here in California, we have the same thing. The population of the states, let's say in the past 25, 30 years, gone from roughly 20 to 25 million to roughly 38 million. So let's say the population is up on the order of 50%, but we don't have 50% more water infrastructure. We haven't built more, plumbing to get this scarce and critical resource to where it needs to be. And then in bucket three, which is the very obvious bucket, we live in the desert, particularly down here in SoCal, maybe not where you are, but all of our water stored in the form of snowpack in your mountains. And so for us, we rely on, trickle-down economics, except for water. The water trickles down the mountains and flows through the canal system and ends up here. So SoCal is naturally a desert, and if there's a disruption in supply, we have problems. Plus, my sense of the way the rainfall system works is we have probably 8 or 9 dry years for every wet year. So last year was a wet year, and all the years leading up to that had been dry years. In fact, going into the wet year, more than half the state was in critical, really critical drought. And in the year before that, you will recall in the Central Valley, the San Joaquin Valley and farther south, up and down both the 5 and the 99 freeways, there were millions and millions of acres of fallow fields because farmers could not get access to water. So that's sort of the backdrop. That's the setup for, you know, the conversation today.
You did say in the article that critical water infrastructure, and you had just alluded to that, that has been neglected for 40 years. Why has that been the case? Given that water is such a critical resource, why have we been so neglectful of the water infrastructure in this country?
I would say there are sort of three reasons for that. The first is political related to budgetary, right? So it's capital and it's money. So the Bay Delta problem, you're familiar with what I'm talking about now, right?
This is Northern California. Just for our listeners who are not familiar with California, we're talking about the Northern California. How would you describe it? It's in the Sacramento area, and it's a critical water intersection. Is that, or how would you describe it, Burl?
Well, you've got a system of estuaries which collect runoff from the Sierra Nevadas in the springtime. So the snowfalls, that's the water supply. The water supply runs down through a system of rivers, dams, canals, piping systems, ends up in the extended version of what you consider the San Francisco Bay. That ends up in the American Canal as the water supply for SoCal. And that whole system is a combination of saltwater, brackish water, inbound and outbound, and a whole series of species that the EPA says are either endangered or threatened. So you have environmental concern on sort of one side. You have human concern, a need for water on the other. And then you have this in the middle, you have money. You have the state of California going, okay, well, what would it cost to really fix this the way it needs to be fixed? And the answer might be $20 billion, which is a whole lot of money. And then you have other concerns, right? We need to rebuild road systems, and there's a variety of other needs that the legislature thinks are important. And water infrastructure has a couple of political, uniquely troublesome political problems. The first is it's a multi-year, multi-decade time frame to fix. And so as a politician, usually because they are constantly up for re-election, they're looking for things to do that are tidy, right? I'm going to open a new post office because I can do it in 2 years. It's inside the framework, which allows me to point to it and run again and say I opened up a new post office for you folks. To fix the water system is like a 10 or 20 year fix. And so it is beyond the tenure of most elected officials. And anything that is beyond their tenure, they generally don't care about because they can't point to it and get reelected. And then the second part is the sheer monetary size of this as a budget item. You would need to say, okay, we're going to budget $4 or $5 billion a year, like for the next 5 to 10 years. And so that requires probably budgetary approval. You might have to put that to the voters. And it's hard to explain to voters how water even works. They just don't even understand where it comes from. They turn on the tap and there it is. So it's a complex problem with complex solutions, and our political system, as you know, is not set up to deal with complex problems and complex solutions. What it's set up to do is provide sound bites for TV interviews. So in my impression, the whole idea that we're choosing not to address it is just because it's hard to address.
Well, now, this is one of the – this is a situation that where there's a lot of private capital that wants access to infrastructure opportunities such as water systems. And the United States, I think, surprisingly, is running behind Canada and Europe in terms of private investment and infrastructure. Is there movement on this in the water arena? Are we going to see more private investment? This program – this magazine, or the magazines that we publish, are all about institutional and even retail investors looking for opportunities. Where's the opportunities in water for the investor?
Well, that is where we think the rubber meets the road. We think that private investment, given correct regulations and given a structure that makes sense, can bridge the gap to public. Private-public partnerships and allowing private companies to come in and put in pipelines and sewer systems and things of that nature, and then charge accordingly, right? I mean, part of the issue is you need to charge folks. And the privatization, here's another issue, and this is not a monetary issue, this is purely emotional. But when you privatize things that were previously the purview of government, there is a group of folks in our society that always get very, very upset. We are invested, our fund is invested in a private company, it's a public company actually, but it's called Cadiz, and it is in the water business. And they own an aquifer underlying the Mojave Desert, and they're preparing to generate and sell to Southern California water agencies enough water for about 400,000 people. Now, this is a private company with private water rights, and they're selling the water at the same price at which the state would, so a buyer is paying no more than they would from the Metropolitan Water District, and the state doesn't have to invest any money. So common sense would tell you this is a good deal. The private industry is stepping in, but the state has failed and doing something beneficial for the community. But if you go to a hearing, you know, they have these open hearings, and they'll have 500 people show up, and of the 500, four of them look like they should have been at Woodstock. Those 400 people strongly, emotionally object to the fact that water's being sold and somebody's making money. Like the idea of a water company selling what they think should be a publicly owned thing. They will sometimes they will take water and put it, they will make it in their head like the idea of air, right? Like, you can't charge me for air, you shouldn't be able to charge me for water, it's a basic human right, how dare you? That kind of idea. And so while that is a minor, that is a small minority of folks, that minority is unbelievably vocal. So one of the problems you have in fixing water, and by the way, there's technical solutions for all of this. I mean, desal, for instance, could provide all the water you'd ever need. But if you look at what happens when someone wants to build a desal plant, a couple of things pop up. One, it's a private company, right? State's not doing this. It's a private developer. So now you have these, for lack of a better description, hippies show up and go crazy because a private developer is going to make money desalinating salt water and then selling it as fresh water, right? So they object to the mere concept. And that will delay a project by 5 to 15 years. And that adds millions and billions of dollars to the cost of everything, thereby reducing the return on equity, heightening the level of risk because there's a chance you don't get approved, and driving up the cost of equity for those projects, making the projects marginally profitable.
But you're building what, the largest desal plant in the world or the country in San Diego right now?
It's already done. It provides 50,000 acre feet of water, right? It's already done.
Okay, now the ocean water is not something that the hippies are not going to show up and say that ocean water is public purview. That's water that I can't drink anyway. Private investors have come in, and they're cleaning the water, and now they're going to sell me water at a price that's what, equivalent to what I would get out of my tap?
No. In the case of desal, it's more expensive. A wholesale water rates in SoCal are about $1,000 an acre foot. Poseidon, which is the facility up the street here, is about $2,000. So San Diego's taking that $2,000 water, and it's like 5 or 10% of the water, so they're mixing it in with all the other stuff, right? But they needed the water. Water costs different, has different costs depending on the source and supply. It's also, you know, when you get your electric bill and there's tier one power and tier two power, right? They charge you more. It's a progressive rate. If you use X amount of power, it costs a dollar. The minute you use more than X, it costs a buck and a half, right? Mm-hmm. Water's the same way. There's tier one and two tier and tier three pricing. But water prices are all set by the Metropolitan Water District, which is a government agency in SoCal. The problem, I mean, you started by saying, yeah, they're taking salt water, which you can't drink, and desalinating and putting it into the water system. So, again, common sense would tell you this is beneficial. But without, you know, ascribing any motives of insanity to the hippies, that's not a rational argument to them. The argument to them is a highly emotional argument. I've been to dozens of these meetings. They're not meetings. I've done dozens of these presentations where folks are allowed to, you know, take the dais for 5 minutes and talk about their concerns. And not a one of them has any linear thinking. There's not a single fact. It's basically crying, screaming, complaining, and pointing to corporate America as evil. And the conversations go off kilter immediately into things like the Trilateral Commission and the Koch brothers, which have nothing to do, of course, with Poseidon.
Well, but let's also, the other argument against desal plants is they use enormous amounts of energy. Is the San Diego plant, is that being, do you have renewable energy there? Is solar and wind supplying a lion's share or all of the energy that's required?
I can't answer the question because it's not like Poseidon would have its own energy source. You know, we have an integrated energy delivery system in the county, and we have 3 million people. And I can't tell you, you could ask Sempra what their sources of energy are. Some of it is probably nuclear, some of it is probably nat gas, some of it is probably wind, some of it is probably solar. And I don't, by the way, I don't know what the pie chart looks like. And it doesn't matter. Because
so let's
whatever
broaden,
the pie chart is,
let's broaden
what,
this out,
that's
then.
What any user is going to use.
Let's broaden
right.
it nationally then. I mean, why with these vast coastlines of the United States are we not building more desalination plants when we know that environmentally, just in terms of nature, precipitation is not level from year to year. It's
right.
obviously gotten very up and down, always has been up and down. Why not more desal plants? And I actually don't think our listeners will accept that it's the hippies. There's got to be more to it than that.
There are two or three things. One is the cost, right? So you're building a water purification system that costs more, typically, than wholesale pricing. Okay. Two is these things are always built on the beach. And people object to anything built on the beach. Period. Doesn't matter what you're building. I guarantee you somebody's going to object because it ruins the view or someone had a view of the ocean and now they don't. Point three is you've got power, right? These things suck up power. And point four is they return heated water back to the ocean. And someone will complain that where the pipe exit is, it's changing in a very modest level the ecosystem of that particular area of the oceans. Now, the other thing is that the practicality issue. Desal is super efficient, but the water you're making is at the beach. And let's say you're Texas, and it's fine if the water user is Corpus Christi, but if the water user is Dallas, you've got to get the water to Dallas, right? And it might be 600 miles of piping. So water desal works brilliantly around the world. The South Koreans, the Israelis, there's hundreds of installations where this is super efficient. America has been very slow to pick up on this. But
can we not do this offshore? Can we not? We build these giant oil platforms offshore.
Uh-huh.
Can we not build a desal plant offshore so we get around
yeah.
the? And then you, and then it's a pipeline. You know, I mean, how long a pipeline is? It's not going to be that long a pipeline. But you get around the argument that you're taking up beachfront property.
Correct. In fact, that's an interesting point. There are companies out now working on the idea of retrofitting tankers and parking a tanker off the shore and having the tanker act as a desal plant.
Sounds like a cool idea.
Now, but except that the tanker needs electricity. So do you build a natural gas-powered cogen plant on the tanker itself, or do you pipe electricity out? So you end up with some of the same issues. The other thing is, now, this would not apply in places like Texas or Florida, but in California, the California Coastal Commission considers its purview to be that. And so even though you weren't on land, let's say you decided to do this, you know, 2 miles out to sea, so you had a reasonable run of pumping the water in and out, the Coastal Commission would still have a set of regulations you need to get to. Part of what I'm saying, by the way, is not that it's impossible. I'm not describing an impossible situation at all. What I'm describing is a project that should take 3 years taking 13.
Mm.
And if I went to you, let's say you're an equity investor, let's say you're BlackRock, and I come to you with this idea, and you start to underwrite it, and then you're having your board meeting, you're thinking, but what if it doesn't get approved? Now, you know it probably will get approved, but what if it takes 13 years instead of three?
Isn't that baked into the cake, though?
But it raises your cost of equity enormously because your money is outstanding for 13 years instead of three. You can't even imagine what this does to your balance sheet.
Mm.
Secondly, it drives up risk. The idea alone that you might not get approved, it becomes like developing drugs, right? What if I go into phase three with the drug and it doesn't work? So there's another narrative here that you're sort of missing, that I will not missing, that the reader's missing because I haven't explained it, is that if you actually went and talked to the environmentalists, and I have had lots of conversations with them, and you get somebody logical, what they really tell you is their narrative is better served if Californians have a scarcity of water. And what their narrative is we don't want anything built. We don't want to approve stadiums, roads, highways, hospitals. We don't approve anything. We want nothing else ever to be built. And one of the ways we achieve that, at a broader sense, at 30,000 feet, is to simply deny you water. if we can stop additional water supplies from coming to SoCal, that way we can lobby, let's say, at the Orange County Building Association, say things like, well, you know, you can't build another 1,000 houses because you don't have water for them. So cutting off water supply or reducing water supply, reducing access to additional water supply, very much serves their broader narrative. And their broader narrative is, we don't want anything ever to be built again in this state. Now, this is not true, by the way, once you get to Texas and Florida. They have different political communities, and they have a different way of perceiving life, right? California is very different in this regard.
So let's take it out of California for just a second and talk about, let's talk about the water infrastructure in the country in general. Where is this situation, other than California, because obviously California got water problems, where is the situation
it's not critical, geographically
it's here. Speaking? Or,
it's here.
But if we get outside of California, are you saying that we don't have a critical water infrastructure situation in other states of the country?
Well, we have degrading infrastructure everywhere, from Maine to San Diego. But on the eastern side of the Continental Divide, okay, so the Continental Divide essentially is Denver, right? If you think about the Rockies, that's the Continental Divide. On the eastern side of the Continental Divide, in most locations, not in places like East Texas, but in most locations, there's significant and sufficient groundwater combined with lakes and rivers. And so from sort of Denver east, the problem you have is aging physical infrastructure. From Denver west, the problem you have is aging physical infrastructure plus drought, right? Now, there are droughts now in places like Texas and in Illinois, and there's, you know, things like that, but they don't live in the desert naturally. I mean, most parts of the country get 70 inches of rain. California gets 7. SoCal gets 7. So we have a combination of this, our piping is falling apart kind of idea, combined with the fact that we don't have natural flow. If you were having this conversation in Washington, D.C., you'd say, well, right there we have the Potomac River. We can just, you know, or the Susquehanna, or we have, you know, lakes and reservoirs and whatnot. So it's much less acute other than places like, in this case we're using Flint, Michigan, because it's an obvious example. But in California, this is much more acute because you have drought. Next year, I probably will be a drought year. The next 8 or 9 years will be drought years, and we'll be back to the same conversation we were having 2 years ago. I can think an environmentalist would tell you. First thing is they would never say this publicly. They would have a series of reasons that they objected to your thing. Oh, we don't like this, we don't like that, blah, blah, blah. But the actual underlying debate, when you get, if you were at the Center of a Biological Diversity's board meeting, this is what they'd be talking about. The way we serve our greater good, and our greater good, by the way, is to have no development of anything, anytime, anywhere, is to cut off water supply. The other thing that they're interested in is if we cut off water supply and we don't have any more water, we can force, we can shove down the throats of the California population this idea, and they'll buy it, that they need to conserve. We can have them, and it's everything from, I would like you to do low-flow toilets and low-flow shower heads to desert landscaping, drought-resistant landscaping, to reduced industrial use, to let's shut down car washes, or let's allow you to water your lawn maybe every other day, or let's go to the extreme, and this I've seen this, is we don't serve people water in restaurants. Like, you think that makes any difference at all, really, that somebody hands you a cup of water in a restaurant? But they will do this. And the folks that run our state, Jerry Brown and his friends, all of whom are Democrats, they like this idea, right? This kind of appeals to them. And so in the last, if you go back to 2015, 2014, 2016, you remember this? In SoCal, everything's rationed. Water was rationed everywhere. And they created neighborly enemies. Your neighbor would rat on you for using a hose to wash the side of your house or to, you know, spray off your patio. Now, that's not happening now because we've gotten some water. But this was part of the thing that they were very focused on. And if you had been the governor, you know, you say to yourself, okay, I've got 25 million people living in the desert. I have two choices. One, I can have them not use as much water as they would like to. Or B, I can create more water. Now, you and I might sit here and debate both of those arguments. The legislator at our state They don't debate that argument. They don't bother with create more water. They just say, no, let's just restrict water. Because it serves the narrative that they're interested in. This is, so much of this is emotional and political. If I took you to one of these
Believe me, I
you would walk out of the room thinking you had literally lost your mind. Like you were talking to people from Mars.
Yeah, no, I've been to many of these meetings you're talking about, city council meetings and sanitation district meetings, back when I was cutting my teeth as a young reporter, and just developers trying to build things, believe me. I hear you, Burl, and I have to say we're out of time right now, but suffice it to say we have not heard the last of Burl East. We will have you on again, Burl. And to our listeners, the June edition of Real Assets Advisor magazine, check out the article by Burl East. Again, the headline is, like oil and water, Burl East is the CEO of American Assets Capital Advisors. Great having you on the program. Thank you for joining us.
Well, Mike, thank you so much. I look forward to coming back at your leisure.